From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, moments of high strangeness with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. But here's what's happening. 1,500 homes evacuated in Los Angeles County as a fire is spreading. A brush fire swept over more than 7 square miles, prompting evacuations and burned structures in rural Los Angeles County as water-dropping helicopters and crews scrambling to get ahead of the blaze. Flames exploded through very dry grasses, jumped roads, and sped across the hills that connect Los Angeles to the high desert. It's a very dry time out there in L.A. U.S. officials sought to reassure fishermen that they will not lose out in the next phase of the Gulf of Mexico oil cleanup while legal wranglings began for the BP trial of the decade. As final preparations were put in place for operations next week to hopefully permanently kill the well, U.S. Spill Chief Thad Allen convened a meeting of parish presidents in New Orleans to discuss how best to safeguard local jobs going forward. With less oil floating in the Gulf, there are fears that BP might scrap its Vessels of Opportunity program, which right now employs about 1,500 boats, providing desperate fishermen with vital skimming and boom lane work. Captain Kelly Sweeney, who has been monitoring this spill since it happened 100 days ago. Kelly, it appears to me BP is going to try to get out of this program, and that means these fishermen are going to lose some jobs.
I agree with you, George, and ahoy to you and all the listeners. I got word, actually, this is a good place to begin. When all the fishermen, right now, 24% of the Gulf is still closed to fishing. It was up to 37%. Some of it has been reopened as recently as with this last week. Now, a lot of the fishermen who lost their livelihoods were supplemented that income by getting hired by BP for the cleanup. But I got a call this morning from the scene that already BP is starting to lay people off of this oil spill cleanup, and that they have no plans to hire any more vessels of opportunity. They're not going to have any more people in the program. And, you know, that concerns me greatly because, number one, you know, this well is not closed, okay? This is not a done deal yet. To already start having people laid off, to me, is unthinkable. Number two, the oil plumes that we've talked about, and all that, of course, not to mention the millions of gallons of dispersant that's in the Gulf already, but the oil plumes, they have no idea where they're going to be impacting fishing areas and shrimping areas. And to me, it's unthinkable that they're already laying people off, and I just can't believe that.
These are going to be the ramifications, Kelly, for years to come.
Okay? I don't think there's any question. And the claims is a big thing, too, George. I was talking with a maritime lawyer today down in the Gulf area, a colleague. And, you know, this is a big deal where this venue is held to hear these claims. BP and Transocean are pushing to have them heard in Houston, which is an area that, and the judges have been traditionally seen as lenient towards the oil industry. And the government, and I think rightly so, is pushing to have the hearings and these court cases heard in New Orleans, because this is Louisiana is where the oil has impacted the most number of fishermen, getting back to them, and where the state that's been impacted most by the oil spill in general. So there's a big thing going on where they're going to hear these things. It's a big deal where they're going to decide to do it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kelly. And of course, an oil spill this week from an underground pipeline connecting the United States to Canada has prompted local health officials to call for the evacuation of as many 50 homes, and they have recommended to residents living close to the river to stop using well water for drinking and cooking. The spill contaminated more than 20 miles of the Kalamazoo River. The pipeline's Canadian owner has already capped it, but, already they're telling 20-some residents and 50 homes to just get out. Be careful. Foreclosures rose in 3 out of every 4 large U.S. metro areas in this year's first half, likely ruling out any sustained home price gains until, they say, 2013. Unemployment was the main culprit, driving foreclosure actions on more than 1.6 million properties. Estimates of the number of graves that might be affected by mix-ups at the Arlington National Cemetery grew from hundreds to as many as 6,600, as the cemetery's former superintendent blamed his staff and a lack of resources for the scandal that forced his ouster. John Metzler, who ran the historic military burial ground for 19 years, says he accepts full responsibility, but he said he also denied some of the findings by the Army investigators and suggested cemetery employees and poor technology were to blame for remains that may have been misidentified or misplaced. U.S. researchers have developed a promising new technique that might one day enable doctors to regrow broken or diseased joints in patients. Writing in The Lancet, U.S. researchers say they have regrown the forelimb thigh joint of rabbits using their own stem cells. Scientists say they have shown proof of principle for the technique, which could replace hips. It was the first time an entire joint surface had been regenerated with the return of functions. The research could benefit patients with damaged hips, shoulders, or knees. A 40-year-old from the village in southwest China is hoping to claim the title of the world's shortest man. We've got that story for you at coasttocoastam.com in the news. At just under 2 feet 6 inches, Huang Hua is only 1.4 centimeters higher than the previous record holder. He was Ping Ping, who died in March. He was only 21. This other man, who smokes heavily and is a former magician, is the height and weight of an average 3-year-old. He's known to locals as Short Brother. He still lives with his mother. His mother says he didn't grow at all 1 month after birth. We thought it was just late development and didn't pay enough attention to him. And another story in the news at coasttocoastam.com, a ship lost for more than 150 years is recovered pretty well intact. It was abandoned in the ice in 1853. It's an incredible story. Go take a look at that, coasttocoastam.com. And the partial set of British wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill's gold-mounted dentures has fetched $23,770 at auction, over three times the estimate. The false teeth, specifically designed to disguise Churchill's lisp, were sold by the son of the technician who was commissioned to make them. What's the latest happenings all around this planet with UFO reporting? Up next, Peter Davenport for the full hour from the National UFO Reporting Center, next on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got Peter Davenport for you this hour. He's the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. He experienced his first UFO sighting not far from where I am, over the St. Louis Airport in the summer of 1954. Peter's with us to take your calls later on the program as well. Peter, how are you?
I am doing well, George, and thank you very much for having me on. It's always an exciting adventure to appear on this program. I'm delighted to be back. And I'd like to begin by thanking all those ladies and gentlemen who submitted reports of their sightings on or about the 4th of July this year in response to my appearance back on the 6th of July, I think it was. We got a slew of reports from coast-to-coast listeners.
What do you think folks were seeing? Because I got all kinds of emails as well, Peter. You were on with us a couple days after Independence Day.
Yep.
What do you think was up there in the sky?
Well, I don't know, George, and that's not unusual. People call me to claim the things they've seen, to describe the things they've seen, and I rarely know, rarely able to identify positively what it is they've seen. But I was going through our database just before the program. We got about 185 reports just for the evening of the 4th of July. But I started scrolling back through the data we collected, and this phenomenon appears to have started as early as the first week of June. So it's been going on, or it went on, for about 7 weeks. And it's tempting to say, well, these objects clearly were nothing but Chinese or Japanese lanterns, pyrotechnic devices, essentially, hot air lanterns. But I don't think they were, based on what people have told me about their sightings.
No, not at all. So let's put that one aside for now. What else are you getting these days, Peter?
We're getting all sorts of interesting reports, Jeff, George. And The one thing that has occurred to me this month, you know, UFO investigators have been saying for decades, almost ever since the beginning of this phenomenon back in June of 1947, when we first awakened to what was going on, that some kind of full disclosure or some kind of landing is going to take place imminently. It hasn't happened in those 47 or more, well, 62 years, I guess now. But based on the volume and the nature of the reports that I've been getting, that question has been surging back and forth in my mind. These are really interesting reports that I've been getting over the last 7 months, and or roughly 7 weeks, I should say, and the sightings are dramatic. They're an overt display of multiple objects seen over populated areas and witnessed by many people. I don't believe I've seen a phenomenon like that since I started this job 16 years ago.
And Peter, are these reports getting better? By that I mean, are the people who are reporting whatever these things are they more concise? Are they reporting these stories better?
Thank you for that question. I wish that were the case, George.
Ah.
But what has happened is since the advent of the cell telephone, people have gotten a little bit careless. In fact, a lot of the calls 5 years ago, I would say maybe 5% of the calls I was getting were prank or hoax calls. Some days, currently, I would say between 50 and 80% of the calls that come in over our hotline are prank calls. That's unfortunate, and it may compel me to stop using the hotline. People may leave messages, but I'm not going to answer it in a live fashion. But the other thing, with regard to the written reports, which we always ask for, a follow-up written report to any phone call or conversation, is a lot of people are submitting their reports, I presume, via texting.
Uh-huh.
And the quality of their text, I have to say, is lower than I wish were the case. But we're grateful for any report we get. If people see what they believe may have been a UFO, I'll take a report in any form just to get the information.
Well, you know, do you have caller ID on the National UFO Reporting Center hotline? Because if you don't, you should. And then you can, if they don't call you with a legitimate number, don't pick it up. If you have a legitimate number and they're still pranking you, then at least you'll have a number and you can call them back at 7 in the morning and wake them up and stuff like that.
We've thought of that many times. I hate to return a prank with a prank, but just yesterday, ironically, for the first time, we had a young fellow who called from Casey, Iowa. He called here 26 times in rapid sequence. One of the most foul-mouthed young little preteens that I've ever heard in my life, I think.
He may be the same idiot who emails us 70 times a day, by the way.
Yeah.
But we're closing in on his IP address, Peter.
Good. Well, it's unsettling to me to see how many people we have in our society who don't seem to engage in their affairs in a serious-minded fashion and whose principal form of entertainment seems to be to pester or annoy other people who are trying their level best to do productive work. And
well, they think it's
we can stop that.
Absolutely. Understand you're thinking of betting the folks at SETI. What's that all about?
Well, I'm pleased to talk about that, George. For the last 15 years, I have been trying to awaken the UFO community to the fact that we now have the technology. Because of the dramatic developments in computers, because of the presence of the global positioning system that has a very, very accurate time constant on it, we should be able to get to graduate from taking eyewitness reports to actually directly registering or measuring, detecting the presence of UFOs in the near-Earth environment. This is a paper. I wrote a paper in preparation for the 2004 MUFON Symposium in Denver, to which I'd been invited to speak. And I proposed that what we build is what is known as a passive radar system, would cover most of the North American continent, just two or three stations, we could cover most of the North American continent. And IS, which is available over my website, ufocenter.com, that we could detect UFOs out to a distance of about 250,000 statute miles from the surface of our planet. Once we are able to do that, the skeptics and the debunkers and the government are suddenly passengers, because we're going to be able to show definitively if UFOs are real and if they reflect electromagnetic radiation or radio waves, then we can show that they are there. And I'm very excited about this project. And I think the reason SETI comes into the picture is I think that if we are able to build one of these systems, and I hope we will in the near future, we can show, before SETI can show, that we are not the only sentient life in our galaxy and therefore the universe. That's what I would like to do.
And you know, Peter, if even one UFO case ended up being the only real case, and all the others, hundreds of thousands of them, all of them were either man-made objects or celestial objects, it doesn't matter. You still have that one real one.
That's right. Statisticians have observed, and others have observed as well, that it's much easier to show that something exists than it is to show that something does not exist. And I agree with you entirely, George. If we can show just one UFO sighting, one UFO detection with a passive radar system, then I think we will have rounded the corner in ufology, and that's what we have to do. We've got to get away from eyewitness accounts. We've got to get away from fuzzy video and fuzzy still photos, and I think passive radar is what will allow us to do it. I'm looking forward to this project, and if anybody would like to read my paper, it's about a 16-page paper, they can access it on our website, ufocenter.com, directly from the homepage.
Super. You passed on some information to the director of the Illinois Mutual UFO Network about a mutilated car case. What the heck was that?
I think I made a brief appearance on Coast shortly after this occurred, George.
It was a couple years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was almost 2 years ago. It was November 4th, 2008, Tuesday night. And I'll bet you there are a lot of our listeners right now who recognize the significance of that date. And I'm going to come back to the significance of that date in a few moments. But what happened was, at about 9:25 or 9:30 that night, a young woman left her apartment. She's a young university student. Left her apartment to go visit, I think, her boyfriend. She jumped in her late model black Japanese sedan, four-door sedan, and started heading for the freeway. People can see on our website what happened to that car when she got just a few blocks from her house. This is a celebrated case now among people who follow our data. But suddenly, as she was going down the center lane of a three-lane road, her car was shoved to the right very suddenly, within a second or two. And it was so abrupt and so bizarre that within a block or maybe a half a block, she pulled off the roadway she was on. She got out of her car and she surveyed the left-hand side of her car. And she was absolutely flabbergasted, George, by what she saw. Her car, the left side and left side only, was pressed in and convoluted in a most complex fashion. People can see the three photos of what that car looked like. The interesting thing about this case, Sam Maranto, the state director of Mutual UFO Network in Illinois, followed up on this case at my request and talked to the young woman, took some very good photographs, and initiated an investigation, sampled the paint chips, started a formal investigation. The long and the short of it is, about 2 months, maybe 3 months after the incident had occurred, specifically, I believe it was on the 16th of February, 2009, all of the evidence disappeared, I believe, on the same day. Somebody must have been very, very interested in that evidence. And somebody must have been very well funded, very well organized, and they must have realized the significance of that very interesting evidence that was taken.
What a story. Stick around, Peter. We're going to take phone calls with you next. Peter Davenport with us from the National UFO Reporting Center. Well, next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton-Howe joins us with some incredible stories. Just get around the campfire, stay at home, lounge on the couch, stay in bed, be in your truck, wherever you are. Get ready for those stories. And when we come back with Peter Davenport, we'll chat with him about how he thinks the government is suppressing information, holding back from us, and then we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, I'm glad we're taking phone calls with you. We haven't done that in a long time. What's your take on government? Are they holding back, and why?
Yeah, that's the ultimate question, George, about the UFO phenomenon. And it is the one that causes me my greatest concern. I can, with great confidence, say that the U.S. government, certain people inside the U.S. government, are quite aware of the UFO phenomenon. And I can say that because of a telephone conversation I had and later an actual meeting on the East Coast with some people from the federal government who occupy positions of considerable responsibility in it, or they did back in 1997 when all this occurred. They called me from the East Coast, and this is an incident. This is a meeting that I have discussed, I think, a couple times on Coast in decades past. They called me from the East Coast, and they said, Peter, we know who you are. We've heard you on Coast to Coast. We've seen you on television. We've been to your website. We've read every report that you've posted there, which back in 1997 wasn't that difficult to do. They said, you have posted information to your website that we are very interested in, but we cannot tell you why we are interested in it. This is April of 1997, late April. They said, we wonder if you could come to the East Coast and sit down with a group of us and talk about these cases and probably other subjects as well. Well, that meeting took place, George. It was on a Friday morning. It was either the 9th or the 16th of May, 1997. We got coffee cups charged. These people were 32 minutes late for a 10 a.m. meeting. They're not the type of people I felt entirely comfortable chastising for being 32 minutes late for a meeting with a half-baked UFO investigator, but they were very polite, very cordial. We got coffee cups charged, and we sat down around a conference table, and they said three things to me, which is everything I need to vindicate all the work, all the 16 years that I've devoted to this job. They said three things in rapid sequence, George. Number one, they said, we know that UFOs are real. At this point, I sat up and started taking notice because this runs obviously counter to the notion that the government would like us all to adopt, namely that the UFO phenomenon is just fiction or nonsense, which is clearly not the case. Number two, they said that we know in the U.S. government that UFOs are what they appear to be, namely sophisticated craft under intelligent control. And number three, we inside the government are a bit concerned about them. Well, I almost fell off my chair. But they then quickly went on to say, you have posted these reports to your website, and we would like you, in your own words, to tell us all you can about those sighting reports. And forgive us, we cannot tell you why we are interested in these reports. But the reports had to do with the alleged presence of a UFO near to an airline, a commercial airliner. This was shortly after the tragic TWA 800 case off Long Island. That was July of 96. This meeting occurred in May of 97, and that appeared to be their principal interest, although we talked about many, many other subjects. Very interesting meeting. I've had communications with these people since that first meeting, and I think they recognize, and they've telegraphed this to me, they've conveyed this fact, that they recognize that the data I am posting to our website is, in many cases, serious-minded, accurate, meaningful data about the UFO phenomenon.
Let's go take some calls. First-time caller in Middletown, Delaware is Aaron. You're on with us at Peter Davenport. Go ahead, Aaron.
I was doing some astronomy.
Okay.
I was looking at Jupiter at like 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
I figured there would be no planes out. And I looked at the sky, I looked at Jupiter, and then I looked to the left, and there was a light going across. I thought it was a plane, so I watched it for a couple of seconds. And then it disappeared. Normally, after a plane turns off its lights, you can kind of see its shadow a bit. There was no shadow afterwards, and I didn't see it for the rest of the night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, if I may comment, Aaron, thank you very much for the call, and thank you for being out at night looking at the night sky. You probably are quite familiar with the night sky. You're one of the few people who knows that Jupiter comes up over the eastern horizon about 11 p.m. or midnight. I compliment you for that. But there are many, many lights in the night sky. Are you familiar with satellites? First question.
Yeah, I was thinking it was a satellite, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting for it to go full circle across the sky.
You bet. It may well have been. The fact that it disappeared, if it was coursing to the east and it disappeared from sight, that is similar to many, many, many reports that I take traditionally, and it is because satellites are visible to us here down on the surface of the Earth solely because they are in direct illumination from the sun.
Right.
When they fly into the shadow behind the Earth, they disappear from our sight, and there are many such reports in our database. I cannot say what it is that you saw there, but I would invite you to submit a short written report, just one or two paragraphs, and we will then compare your report to reports from the same area of the country and also from the same time period. So we traditionally ask people to submit written reports. That's the only kind of report that we can really do anything with.
Thanks, Aaron. What kind of reports do you look for, Peter? I mean, you know, everybody could call and say, look, I saw lights. That doesn't give you anything definitive. Are you looking for more than that?
Absolutely. And you make a very good point, George, that I would like to underscore with our Coast listeners tonight, and that is there are many, many, many lights in the night sky, even the daytime sky, that people are unable to identify. Only very few of them, is my estimate, are actual alien spaceships. I believe that we are being visited. I believe that we are being visited on a regular basis, and the government knows about it. But very few of the reports that come to us, I would estimate, I used to say about 50%, then it was down to 30%. I'm down to 10% now. I estimate that only potentially 10% of the reports that come to us do I think are probably descriptions of genuine UFOs. A lot of people see a lot of things. Jupiter, Venus, people report the International Space Station flying overhead.
Military craft that, you know, might be years ahead of being unveiled here.
Quite possibly, but the argument that a lot of these reports are caused by exotic military equipment, I haven't yet warmed up to, because most of those aircraft or reconnaissance platforms probably are capable of very high speed. And if it's very high speed, they have very powerful engines. And that's not something that is going to hover over your back lot. So the argument that most of these sightings of anomalous objects are of military equipment, as I say, I haven't yet warmed up to.
Okay, go next to Oklahoma, east of the Rockies. Robin's with us. Hey, Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Mr.
Devin.
Davenport.
Peter.
Well, Peter.
Hi, Robin.
I guess he kind of blew it. What I saw was in the east, but it had, I talked to the satellite dish place. It's says it on the TV, it's like 22,000 miles up, and I asked them if we could see it. And they were kind of laughing at me, going, nah, you know. But what I saw, this was like 3 or 4 years ago, and it had lights on it, and it just kind of moved back and forth. I don't know what it was.
Well,
I even got the binoculars out and looked at it.
Yep. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your call, Robin. Very interesting report. But this underscores the importance of reporting a sighting of something unusual as quickly as you can. It's very difficult, probably impossible would be a better term in this instance, for a UFO investigator to identify what a person has seen 3 years ago. And it's very, very difficult, borderline impossible, to try to find other witnesses to the same case without photographic evidence, without other witnesses, without, most of all, written, detailed statements of what witnesses have seen. It is almost impossible for a person in my position to be able to say what it was you saw that night.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Let's go to Asotin, Washington, west of the Rockies. It's Susan's turn. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I think I've got the information that you're looking for. Actually, I go to SOHO. It's NASA's website probably every day. And today, actually, you guys probably will want to look it up. You go to the box where it says The Sun Now, and it does say CCP burnout. Well, click it anyways. And then you go to Laszlo C2 box, and then you go to right below it says more, and it'll say 512 by 512, and that's for your pictures, more pictures of the time. Now, what you're going to want to do is go to, it starts at 728.
Well, what are we going to be looking at, Susan? Because
okay,
it's easier for people to find.
Okay, the sun does an explosion. Okay, CME, but the thing is it hit something. This is the strangest I've ever seen. It hits something, and you can see it, and it stays there. The explosion goes out, okay, and it's 12-minute intervals on the pictures, and the pictures start at 18:12 on 728, and they go all the way through till 729.
Well, how do you know it hit something, Susan?
Because you can see it.
You can see whatever it hit?
Yes.
What did it look like?
It's round and it's big.
Peter, I've never heard of this one before.
It's today. Yeah, I went on for an hour this morning, and all then right. I went back this afternoon. Now, the last picture where you don't see it anymore is at 729 at 634.
All right.
That's the picture where you don't see it anymore. The picture right before.
What do you think this is, Peter?
Well, it's very difficult to comment intelligently until I've seen the data. But I will say thanks very much for the call, Susan. It's nice to talk to a fellow Washingtonian. I'm sitting in the same state that you are, of course.
Are you still in a missile silo?
Well, I'm not in it, George. I'm about 7 miles south of it, but
right.
Someday I may live in it if I screw up my courage and finally get it cleaned up. It is a big, big and dirty facility. But we got, here at the National UFO Reporting Center, we got many, many reports from the SOHO site. But in my opinion, most of the anomalous information that appears on that site is due to optical aberration or perhaps a data drop. I'm not familiar with the system. I'm not familiar with how they post information to that site. But I haven't seen anything on that site yet that captures my attention and suggests to me that it is capturing genuine UFOs. After all, if they were as big as they appear in some of those photographs and they're near to the sun, they must be gigantic. And that seems highly unlikely to me based on my experience.
We have a text in for you. Joey from Tampa Bay wants to know if you think that disclosure will happen before 2012.
Well, I'm one of those people who doesn't place any great significance on the year 2012, but I can answer Joey's question nevertheless. Very interesting question. All of us UFO investigators are asking ourselves, I think, how long the government is going to be able to keep the lid on the UFO subject. If I'm able to build a passive radar system, not very long. But other countries, other governments have admitted that they recognize the UFO phenomenon as a real phenomenon. Back about 10 or 12 years ago, the French government, or some of the former public servants of the French government, released the Cometa report, C-O-M-E-T-A, very, very interesting document. Now, thanks to Stan Friedman, I think it's been translated to English. 2 years ago, I think it was May 14th, 2008, the English government came forward and said they were going to be releasing their files. They've been releasing them by the thousands, if not the tens of thousands. You have to admit that that's a lot of information about UFO sighting reports that they claimed were just a fiction, that the phenomenon was not a real phenomenon. Chile has done the same. Belgium has done it. It's a question of how long the U.S. government is going to masquerade by pretending that the UFO phenomenon is not real. It clearly is. And I think the evidence is mounting, and I think ultimately the government's going to have to reveal to the American people the information they have on this subject.
One or two more callers here for you. Peter, James in Johnson City, Tennessee is on Coast to Coast. Hi, James.
Hey, George. How are you doing, sir? Okay. Peter, how are you doing this evening?
You're doing well, James. Thanks for your call.
Yes, sir. I'm in law enforcement, and, of course, I work in the foothills of Tennessee, and so every night I see various objects throughout the sky, whether it be satellites, shooting stars, planets, and such. But I had an experience maybe a couple of months ago that was a little out of the ordinary, and we had received a call on it, and it was evidently a quote-unquote floating orb over the farm field. And you know, such calls come in from time to time, but I responded to it and observed that it was not so much an orb as it was, you know, a usual quote-unquote cigar-shaped UFO, unidentified flying object. And there was not one single source of light on it that was dipping off, but rather the entire hull or skin, if you will, was irradiating. And it climbed maybe 400 or 500 feet. By my estimate, and the lights went off, but I could see markings on it. And to my surprise, it was standard, you know, English markings. If memory serves correct, it revealed Sierra Foxtrot or SF 189, which was very interesting to me because here I am thinking, my gosh, you know, alien invasion or something, but I'm seeing legible English written on the side of it. After that, it just seemed to literally evaporate into midair. And so after that, you know, especially with legible English markings, it was hard to fathom that that could be an alien craft.
Oh, no, I would agree with you on that, James. And Peter, years ago, several police officers, as you know, from Millstadt, Illinois, saw a huge triangular-shaped object, and they still can't figure out what they saw. You remember that case?
Absolutely. I took the first call from Ed at 02:38 hours on the 5th of January, 2000, George. I remember that case very, very clearly.
It was one of the best. One of the. Hey, Peter,
dramatic case, you bet.
I want to thank you for spending the hour. We got to do this more often. Peter's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's the ufocenter.com. And by the way, always check our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. As a matter of fact, Lex has a couple links up there for you too. So there you go. We'll be back with Linda Moulton Howe.